they say that Christianity's got a good message. It's just that who's interested anymore? Who's interested anymore? What do they mean by that? Well, people aren't interested in whether they're righteous in God's sight. They're much more interested in how are they going to buy that new car or pay for their house mortgage or raise their kids right. They need practical advice, particularly from the church. That's what they're going to worship services for. And if you're a pastor and really want to get applauded by your congregation, do a practical advice sermon. And if you use the word Jesus, just put him in as a power source or something, and then sit back and get ready for the accolades. Because the old Adam just really loves to hear a sermon that doesn't focus on Jesus. But do people want to be justified before God today? That's the question we're going to be answering here on Law and Gospel on this Thursday, March the 1st. March the 1st. What happened to February, Buzz? I don't know. March the 1st, we're in it already, which normally would be the first day I'm back. I wonder how many people are going to be listening tonight at 6 o'clock. What's on at 6 o'clock tonight? The Bible study. Oh, a repeat of the Bible study. Thank you very much. That's right. We're not on anymore at 6 o'clock, folks. We're on from 1 to 3 each afternoon. And I'm wondering if they should make a little pre-announcement to that at the 6 o'clock hour tonight, because I still have people writing me saying, I'm looking forward to you coming back on. Uh-huh. This is a open line where you can phone in and ask any questions as we discuss the topic for today. 505-7850. Toll free at 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email at lawgospel@kfuo.org. Let's begin with this statement. Those who justify themselves are under compulsion to do so, for there is no escape. Those who justify themselves are under compulsion to do so. There is no escape. When we talk about the bondage of the will, it means much more than the inability to make a choice as an unbeliever to believe in Jesus Christ. No unbeliever has that choice to choose Jesus Christ because their will is bound, and it's bound by sin. Therefore, what is the center of sin? Think about it. Spell it. I. What is the center of pride? I. What is the center of That's Isn't it interesting that self is the center of sin? We want to justify ourselves. Think about what brings happiness to your life. Are you not happy when you are recognized and justified in the eyes of others? Well, what's better than receiving a gift is often giving a gift. You can see the person's eyes get big as they begin to open up the package. We have two grandchildren now, and Ashley isn't quite yet ready to open up packages, being only around 3 months old now. But Austin is a pro at it. In fact, if you walk into their house, it's a toy house. They don't have any room to live. It's just toys everywhere because he's an expert at opening up packages. And when you see the gleam in his eye as he goes for the package and tears it up and looks inside and then begins playing with it, you really feel happy. You see, we're always attempting to offer persuasive reasons for living as we do. Why do people lose their temper? Because their ego is really being attacked. That's really at the basis of when people lose their temper. And it happens to every one of us because we want to be in control. And when we're not in control, oh my. Even when you know that, it's really difficult. So psychologists tell us, oh yes, we like to be thought of highly as in the eyes of others. That's one of the problems that the degree of suicide among homosexuals is so high. But when they go to a psychologist today, a lot of psychologists try to help them by saying, no, that's just the Christian fundamentalists who feel that your lifestyle is inappropriate. You should be above that. But you see, you're not just fighting with Christian fundamentalists, or I'm a fundamentalist in that sense, that homosexuality is an invalid lifestyle from God's point of view. You're also fighting with the way God built us. And our conscience shows us. So even if a psychologist may try and smooth out the problems that we're having when we're doing unconfessed sin, the psychologist will never be totally successful. Because by nature, let's think theologically, when we are trying to be justified in the eyes of others, you know what phrase we use to describe that condition? We are seeking to be self-righteous. Advertisers have learned that. We spoke about that on the promo for today. That though there are some theologians who think for some strange reason that people aren't interested in being declared right in God's eyes, the fact of the matter is we sure want to feel right in the eyes of others. So there's an advertisement for a new brand of cleanser. And the homemaker is made to feel guilty if she is not using the right brand of cleanser. Or a young person is made to feel guilty if she's not driving the right kind of sports car. We do not look to God by nature for our righteousness. We look to the world. And what are we looking for? We're looking, first of all, to discover how others think about me, and then my behavior is guided by the results. We think about how the world thinks about me, and then in order to get their thinking where I am being commended, we often will guide our behavior towards that end. Is that not really the definition of a politician? Puts his finger up in the air, sees which way the wind is blowing, and gets on that plane. Now, sometimes that's appropriate. Because sometimes in politics, there are not black and white issues where this is always correct and that's always wrong. There's a need for compromise. And so politicians, to some level, also need to represent the people that elected them. And so they need to know in areas where it is not that important as to whether or not they're going to vote a certain way. For example, in our city, there's a proposal to bring back garbage where we don't pay for it. So the rubbish pickup we wouldn't have to pay for. And a lot of people are for that. But then I heard from someone that, well, right now we do pay for it, but they not only pick up the garbage on Monday, but they pick up all the limbs on Thursday. Now you have to cut them up, but you don't have to rope them or anything. Just put them in a garbage can. It's very, very simple. And I recall one time after a storm, I had 17 garbage cans out there filled with limbs. And I know it was a lot of hard work because I was watching Louise doing it. But at any rate, they picked every one of them up. Now, if I was a politician, would I want to continue the way things are right now, where people pay for their rubbish pickup and therefore get the limbs picked up? Or shall we no longer charge anybody, but then limbs aren't picked up? Well, that's a tough decision. And there's where you'd want to poll your constituency. But then when it comes to moral issues, like abortion or homosexuality or same-sex marriage, and politicians put their finger in the air, that is wrong. There they're trying to get reelected and be justified in the eyes of others. We just live this way, folks. And it is a wrong view. It's a myth that people don't care about being justified in the eyes of God. By nature, they are. In fact, look at history. Is not history a record of the battle for mutual recognition or primary recognition? Can you imagine people actually kill other people because of land? Now, sometimes the two groups are also religiously connected, such as in Ireland, where you have the Protestants and Roman Catholics. But you would think there would be something that could be done where you're not spilling blood just over who owns the land or who has the right to buy it or who's ruling over it. You saw what happened with Hitler as he decided he needed more land or that certain land he didn't have should have been his. Well, it just doesn't stop until the war stopped it. A war often is a record of the battle for primary recognition. Theologically, and now we're moving it into the area of how God looks at it, is a problem of justification, justice from their point of view, and righteousness. Now, one reason a lot of people don't really care much about how God regards them is because they don't care much about God. In the 19th century, a word was coined. It's theodicy. T-H-E-O-D-I-C-Y. It comes from two Greek words, as is usual on this program. The first is theos, T-H-E-O-S, where we get the word theology, words of God, theos, God. And then the second word is the Greek word dike, spelled D-I-K-E, and it's a debate about rights. It's a lawsuit. Theodicy is talking about the need to vindicate God in the face of unexplained evil and suffering. How many times have you been watching a movie and someone, perhaps young, a child, a spouse dies unexpectedly? I enjoy watching British mysteries. Silent Witness is one of my favorites. It's about a number of people in a room of autopsies where they figure out how a person died and try and figure out the murder. One of the things I don't like is when the character lives get intermingled with the plot, the story. I don't like the characters really getting that involved. I like the old Kojak movies where you never even knew if he had a wife. Remember that? Never even knew if he had any children. Well, I think he had a brother. Yeah, his brother worked with him. But his own life? This movie starts off with one of the main characters having both his wife and his daughter killed when a car slams into a restaurant in which they are sitting. And then, of course, it just so happens that on another case they're working on, it's the same individuals involved in both cases. I mean, what kind of coincidence is that? I think it's in the city of London. As big as that is, it's the same individual that both sides are going after. But the point I'm making is that he was really angry at God. He just could not explain. And then all kinds of guilt came upon him. For instance, he realized that he was so busy working autopsies that he really hadn't had enough time with his daughter. And so he felt guilt over that. And then, of course, anybody around him were receiving the brunt of his guilt as he was angrily demanding that the person who did this be caught and very angry over sloppy police evidence and people not telling him everything. All of that is a way of vindicating ourselves and trying to figure out how could God possibly be vindicated in the face of this unexplained evil and suffering. What did I do to deserve this? And a couple of times, at least once, I remember he said, I wish I had been sitting there with them and would be with them right now. Now, you can only imagine when those closest to you, and in his case, his entire family, both his wife and daughter, were killed instantly. What would matter anymore when the family is gone? And so one of the first things that comes about, and psychology talks about this, they talk about the various stages in grief. The first is just rejection. No, it really hasn't happened. Unbelief. No, I won't accept it. Then the next stage is anger. Until you go through the stages where you get to acceptance. But some people never reach that. But theodicy is the same way. No, God wouldn't allow that. There's actually people who say, God isn't involved in any of these horrible things that take place because he's really quite impotent. He is not almighty. That was the answer of a rabbi. Why do bad things happen to good people? And his answer was, is because God is not almighty. You see, they can't figure it out. How can God be almighty and loving and yet allow all this to happen? But what they're not understanding is they're putting their own views of what almighty means and what love means on themselves without recognizing that they themselves also allow suffering to take place on their children, which they could have stopped, and they don't. Of what am I speaking? Well, for instance, just because you reach 16 years old doesn't mean you have to have a car. I was just listening to Mark Hawkinson in the program before mine, and he was playing a song of sorts where it was talking about a father looking at his child as, I think it was a girl, as she grew up, and talking about at 16, maybe she'd get to drive a car. At 21, she'd go out on her first date, but make sure she was home by 8. Now, see, if you do that, then there's no problem with your daughter getting involved with all kinds of inappropriate people if you keep her in house till she's 21. But we don't do that, do we? We allow them freedom. And I can't tell you how many times that one of the children ended up in a car accident or got a speeding ticket or... I remember how I used to punish them. When my son would get a speeding ticket, I'd make him buy a radar detector, which, of course, I used then all the time. and he couldn't understand that one time because the reason he got a speeding ticket is that the policeman was following him and measuring his speed. So a radar detector, there was no radar even on. I think they saw through some of those punishments. But back to the point of justifying ourselves, a lot of people want to try and justify God. They want to vindicate God in the face of unexplained evil and suffering. Read the book of Job. Job just could not believe those three theologians of the glory characters who were telling Job, well, the reason you're suffering so much, Job, is obviously you've done something wrong. If you'll only shape up, you'll be fine like us. Start being more moral. That was their thing. And Job said, wait a minute, I'm not that immoral. I haven't changed from what I used to be. What kind of God is this that you're talking about? And so Job was trying to vindicate God in the face of his unexplained evil and suffering, and he even wanted to have a kind of a court trial where he would be able to explain to God that what God was doing to him was inappropriate. He never lost his faith that the God they were talking about couldn't be God. But until Elihu, that was one of the theologians of the cross in those days, spoke to him, and then God himself spoke to him, did Job recognize that when we are faced with unexplained evil and suffering, what is our response as a believer? To put our hand over our mouth and speak not at all. Because these are things way too beyond our understanding. That's very hard to do. But if we don't do that, listen what God says to Job in chapter 40, verse 8. I believe this is the essence of the book of Job. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Ooh, we do that with people all the time. I mean, it's a joke around our house. We were putting a newsletter together not long ago, and there was the wrong address on there. In fact, my wife, Louise, showed it to me that there were people living in the same town, but the town was spelled differently. So one of them was in error, one of the spellings. And I went down, and sure enough, it was. I came back up, and I announced to everybody, yep, Louise was right. She did misspell it when she typed it. And they all laughed because they know that she doesn't make those kinds of mistakes. But it's just kind of a natural response that you want to, yep, it's, you know, part of the burden I have, having someone who can't seem to use a computer properly, when in reality, it was myself who had made the mistake. It gets to be kind of a joke, but some people really take this seriously. You'll get phone calls about people near a divorce and begin to be speaking about all the things the other person isn't doing properly in their life. And you listen and you listen, and it's kind of like filling up those old green stamps you would get. And if you got so many books of green stamps, you could actually get a television or something. When I was a kid, we were collecting green stamps. It normally was, they normally were received either at grocery stores or gas stations. So when we went on a trip to Florida, I was really looking forward to it because I made sure Dad would stop at every gas station that had green stamps. And I think I was up to 3 books. And a television was only like 313 books, but I mean, it was going to be a while. At any rate, that stopped halfway through the trip when Dad ran out of gas looking for a gas station that had green stamps, and that's the last time we cared about green stamps on that trip. Yeah, I remember it was, we were on an exit ramp, and Dad had to go walking to find somebody who would bring gas to us while we sat in the car. And I didn't talk about green stamps anymore. But that's often what we do. We want to give God a bunch of green stamps and say, look at the things that are happening in my life. How come you're not treating me better? Well, what did I do to, oh, yes, it's heard even by Lutherans. What did I do to deserve that? Well, the question is, what did I do not to deserve it? What have I ever done not to deserve temporal and eternal punishment? And I'm having a problem over a flat tire? Or that a light bulb goes out? We got those new light bulbs where they face up to the ceiling. They're really bright. And the trouble is they're $5 each. And they just seem to blow out when we don't have any more in the house. And it's really dark. A light bulb you get upset over. Isn't that ridiculous? When we get back from the break, we'll talk about a lawsuit against God, which really is another way of trying to justify ourselves. And I think you'll be very interested when we get to the sixth point. It'll surprise you. In the meantime, if you'd like to phone, our numbers here are 505-7850. Toll free 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address at lawgospel@kfuo.org. What we are talking about is how you and I, we just have to justify ourselves, and that's how advertising works. Trying to make us look really good to others. We'll talk more about this when we get back from the break.
Next time on the Bible study, you might hear, I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with string of jewels. You might say, I thought this was a Bible study. I would say it is. We're in the Song of Songs. Next time with Dr. Chris Mitchell, our 10:05 Bible study. Hope you can join us.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
There are some who imagine that the notion of being justified in the sight of God is no longer a concern of most people. How surprised would you be to realize that the foundation of advertising you listen to or watch assumes that you want to be justified in the sight of others? That is the subject of discussion for the next Law and Gospel.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from...
I'm Dr. Bill Meyer for the James Dobson Family Minute. God's ideal in marriage is commitment, but that doesn't mean staying in a life-threatening abusive situation regardless of the risks. My colleague Dr. James Dobson has this observation from the Bible.
I can find it there to say, you get out, and you get out quick. No woman, no child can ever be expected to remain in that kind of situation. You do call 911. You do get help. You do whatever is necessary. You seek help. There are circumstances where if you stay in an abusive situation, virtually all of them, you are an enabler.
If you think that you might be in an abusive relationship, talk with a professional therapist or someone with a clear understanding of abuse. Call the domestic violence hotline in your area or contact us at 1-800-A-FAMILY. For Focus on the Family, I'm Dr. Bill Meyer.
Are you tired of shallow Christianity? Had enough of trendy spirituality? Tune in each week to the White Horse Inn with Michael Horton for informed roundtable discussions of the Bible, theology, church history, and cultural trends. The White Horse Inn. Know what you believe and why you believe it.
Saturday afternoon at 12:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Hi, I'm Pastor Doug Nicely. This Sunday, St. Luke gives us some remarkable words from the lips of Jesus in our gospel reading. Jesus says to the disciples, "How often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing." We'll talk about mother love and Jesus this week on In His Steps.
Listen to In His Steps Saturday at noon with Pastor Doug Nicely on AM 850 KFUO.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace, and I've enjoyed hosting the Woman to Woman show here on KFUO for the last 15 years. I look for ways to nurture, restore, empower, and encourage women, and that's exactly what's coming up March 3rd. It's the 7th annual Women's Day of Renewal at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville. The theme is God's original masterpiece, You. You wonder when you look at the canvas of your life, what's up with this? What's the deal with that? Well, the delightful, insightful Jan Strzok keynotes this event to send you home looking in the mirror and in your life in a refreshing new way. From the continental breakfast to the catered lunch, to the free child care for ages 3 through 4th grade, to the individualized workshops you get to take, it's your day, girl. March 3rd, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Collinsville, just 10 minutes from the Arch. Give yourself this day. Jan Strzok is there. I'm there. Your turn to sign up. Call 618-344-3151 or visit the web, goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Well, I was just told that putting on my program on these new CDs that last for 80 years, nobody wants my program for 80 years, and that's probably correct, except for my mother. All righty, tomorrow on Law and Gospel, it's your turn. Normally during the week, we like to stay on the subject when you phone in, but tomorrow it's open line, although we are going to be talking about how God relates to us makes a big difference on how we relate to God. That'll be part of the subject, and then opening up the phone lines. That's tomorrow on Law and Gospel. That's Friday, March 2nd. Today we're talking about, it is just dead wrong that people are not interested in being justified before others, including God. People do talk about these things. We're going to begin this part of the program by talking about the lawsuits against God. These are questions that may come to your mind as they have to so many Christians over the ages, and they're really somewhat unanswerable, but they're kind of stacked up as a lawsuit against God. A theodicy is the word that we use to talk about this. The first question is the one just about everybody can ask. Why do the just suffer? The second one is, why does God not resist evil? How come he lets it go on and on and on? Which is number three, why does God not intervene? So if you had a parent and you are suffering, and you are just, and God doesn't protect you from evil, and he doesn't intervene, can you imagine question number four is just reasonably the next one? Why does God not seem to care? And number five, why does God evade us? We call upon him and nothing happens. These are questions that are found in the Bible and found in the minds of even Christians as they come face to face with suffering or evil or an uncaring God, and they ask these questions because we put God in the same category as our friends. We consider God just to be another human being with the same kinds of attributes that all human beings have. So if we know of somebody who's allowing us to suffer, not helping us out, not intervening, guess what? They don't seem to care. Now, are you ready for question number six? My God, why have you forsaken me? You know where that's from. It's from Psalm 22 to begin with. But it's also the words from the cross. Christians may even say that at times. As I indicated the head actor on Silent Witness last night, when his wife and daughter died, he was forsaken. He was alone. My God, why have you forsaken me? It was kind of interesting, too. One of his good friends who worked with him, he said, let me go with you. And his response was, no, I need to be alone. I find that very interesting that when help is even proffered, people don't want it. Because they are so angry with God, they don't want to hear anything that could possibly offset that anger or make sense of the nonsensical. My God, why have you forsaken me? There is an answer to that, by the way. In fact, there's an answer to all of these. But it's an answer that the unbelieving human being never will accept. And even believers have a hard time accepting. Why do the just suffer? Because we're not in heaven yet, folks. We're on the earth, and on earth is not his equal, refers to none other than Satan himself. What do you expect? And yet, in the midst of this suffering, guess what? You'll never suffer beyond what you're able to endure. That's God's promise. He controls the suffering. He uses it as a way of you turning in faith more to him. How about, why does God not resist evil? Well, he does. Thousands of times in your life, the devil is resisted in fulfilling the plans that he wishes he could do to you. How many times is it that you were protected from an accident because God just wouldn't let it happen? Do you think the devil ever wants you to go to church and hear God's word? If he had his way, there'd be all kinds of impediments, car accidents. On Sunday morning, expressways totally backed up. So by the time you get to church, the service ended 2 hours before. But none of that happens, or rarely does it happen. So the idea, why does God not intervene? Yes, he is. Through eyes of faith, his intervention is constant because you're his child. And the idea that God does not seem to care, well, that sounds like a little child who can't stay up late to see the latest Japanese movie and gets all upset with mommy or daddy because they make him go to bed. You don't care. You don't love me. It's only because of their care and love that they're telling you to go to bed because you've got a school day next day, and you're simply not going to be able to stay awake. And why does God evade us? That often comes, that question, from those who say, I don't feel close to God. And they're assuming that God moved from them. No, God never moves from the side of the Christian. That's why you never can base your assurance of his presence on your feelings, on your emotions, on your experience. You only can base the assurance of his presence on his promises. He promises never to leave nor forsake you. Which leads to the next one, my God, why have you forsaken me? Old Christians may say that, but they never can say it in truth, because God will never forsake the Christian. It's impossible. He's made a promise. And we understand why Jesus said that, because God the Father truly had forsaken God the Son. Yes, it's a huge mystery to us, but it's not so mysterious that we can't understand it, at least at face value. It still goes beyond our knowledge as to why God set up salvation that way. Wasn't there an easier way for him? I think not. By the way, I get calls at home because some people don't have computers, they can't email me, or for one reason or another. And received a call today about a layman who is going to be giving a devotion. And he was trying to get across the idea where Jesus says, without me you can do nothing, and with me you bear much fruit. And he was trying to think of an analogy. And I'm sure, because this is being broadcast during school time, that none of the students are going to hear what he has to say, and he'll probably do a better job than I'm going to do. But I had actually been a guest in his house when I was doing a seminar in that area, and I just learned, and I talked a little bit about it on the program, how extremely hardworking are farmers who have cows to milk twice a day. It's just really, really hard work in all kinds of weather. So he's trying to figure out, what kind of analogy could you give me? And I said, well, there's one if you look out your bedroom window. The cow does give milk, but only if you feed it. And even when you feed it well, it has an inability to give its own milk. You can put it near a can, but it's not going to be able to go over there and allow the milk to go from its body into the can. No, there has to be some mechanism or hands doing it. And I said, that's, to me, a great analogy of what Jesus is saying. Without me, you can do nothing, and with me, you can bear much fruit. Why? Just as a cow, first of all, needs to be fed, we need to be fed, and what we're fed to bear fruit is word and sacrament. Insofar as we steep ourselves into the holy word of God and receive the sacrament as adults of the Lord's Supper, we are being fed by God each and every day. But that still doesn't mean that we can spontaneously bear fruit of the Spirit, because it's fruit of the Spirit. It's not fruit of Tom Baker, in the sense that by my own natural abilities. So in a sense, the Spirit milks us, that may be a way of speaking of it, to bear fruit. Because on Judgment Day, to whom will you give all the credit for the fruit that you have borne? None other than God himself. In that sense, you know, that's really helpful, because it's the cow's milk. But unless there's something outside of the cow to help distribute the milk, it's not going to be milked. Cows can't milk themselves. You can't bear fruit yourself. It's impossible. You can cooperate with the Holy Spirit. And see, that's what happens when you sin. You kind of kick the bucket away. And some people sin turns to unbelief, so when they kick the bucket away, they knock over the fire, and all Chicago burns down. Well, I mean, these analogies can go on and on and on. So he's thinking of maybe using something like that, and he'll do a lot better because he knows cows and their needs and how much he's involved, but it's very, very hard work for that milk to be finally put on a truck and taken to your home. And a lot of times we don't realize that. The Holy Spirit continues to work in you because God never forsakes you. The lawsuits against God only work if you're an unbeliever. Now, they work for some Christians because most Christians don't think very well. We're so curved in on ourselves. In fact, the Latin for that is incurvatus se. We curve in on ourselves. We look to ourselves. We think we're the center of the universe. Now, there are those philosophers and theologians who try to answer these questions of theodicy, such as, why do bad things happen to good people? Even unbelievers do it. Plato, for example, through rational reasoning, he thought that he could explain how suffering and evil are permitted by God so that good is the result. And how many times have you heard a Christian say something like that? And usually it's always said inappropriately. Like someone is having a baby and the child dies in childbirth or soon after birth. And you go to them and say, well, God will give you another one. That's the good that will come out of this. Now, that's not comforting at all. You may think it's comforting because you're trying to take away their grief, but you don't do so by looking to the good. Or your house burns down and someone comes up to you and says, you know, all things work together for your good. And they don't even have the Bible verse right, because the Bible verse isn't saying that when something bad happens to you as a Christian, that down the road it will work out to good. No. What the Bible verse is saying is that what is happening to you is working out to good. That there's a good in what's happening to you. Now think of discipline. A son is sent to his room for disobeying, and he's not allowed to watch television that night. The good is the actual discipline. Now, there will be good coming from it as he grows up. He will know not to do whatever he had done wrong because there's bad consequences, but the discipline itself is a good thing, too. So some people try to use rational reasoning to explain how suffering and evil are permitted by God so that good is the result. And it's just such a superficial defense against that. That's called contemplative theodicy. How about active theodicy? Probably Immanuel Kant, a great philosopher in his day. He justified God's goodness by declaring that there exists a morality in spite of our worldly experience. That while you're looking at the world, you may think that the whole thing is falling apart, but no, there is a morality out there. There is a right, there is a wrong. We need to learn what is right, what is wrong, and follow it in order that our world can come back together. Now, neither of these really are comforting statements to somebody who's experiencing an evil that they don't think they deserved. But that's the way the world works, in attempting to rationalize. We often talk about the distinction between the unbeliever living under the law, the believer living under the gospel. How are we justified in our life? Well, if you're living under the law, you feel justified by looking at how others regard yourself and your behavior. And if you have a good reputation, you tend to do those things that increase that reputation. If you have a somewhat failing reputation, you'll try and correct it by changing your behavior, perhaps, because the bottom line is what people think about us is really critical. So we try to manipulate how they think about us by doing something that impresses them. That's self-justification. To move into the spiritual realm and do that to God is mortal sin. Because there's nothing that an unbeliever can do to impress God to the point where he says, ah, he is one of my children. First you get adopted, then you're unable to impress God. There's no impression you make on God prior to the adoption by your works. If anything, your works would be a way that God would stay an arm's length from you. So when you're living under the gospel, how are you justified? You're justified because of the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. Now let me explain that, because so often we just say it and we leave it there. And people say, well, yeah, that sounds good. What does it mean? Well, when you're not justified before God, why do you think you're not justified? Because you don't think that God regards you as righteous. Because when you look at yourself, you're not righteous. And if you ever think that you are righteous enough, then it is self-righteousness, self-justification. And that's a sin. But when God looks at you, how can he regard you as righteous when in reality you are not, according to your behavior? Because God no longer looks at your behavior. I'll say that again. God no longer looks at your behavior when he's making a declaration that you are righteous in his sight. What he does, he looks at the behavior of his son, who died to pay for your sins. In theology, we call it his passive righteousness, that Christ passively died on the cross, like a sheep led to the slaughter, doesn't make a noise. Jesus willingly went to the cross on your behalf. The reason you are righteous in God's sight is not because of any righteousness of your own, but because there was a glorious exchange took place when you gave God the only thing he really wants from you, namely your sin. And he gave you the only thing you need from him, his righteousness. The Christian finds meaning in life because in whatever station you're in, God is using you to accomplish his purposes. And apart from you, God won't accomplish his purposes. What? Well, his purpose is that many more would come to a knowledge of Jesus Christ. Let's say the world's going to go another 1,000 years, so you got maybe 2 billion more people who are going to become Christian. If everyone on earth never spoke a word from the Bible and destroyed all the Bibles, nobody else could become a Christian. And the only way these people are going to be converted is by hearing the word of God from sinful human beings. We don't really like passive righteousness, namely that Jesus died and I got his righteousness. We try to destroy it by thinking that we're justified because we're just as good as anyone else. In fact, I'm probably better than most people I know. So we justify ourselves by thinking and also by doing. We think of ourselves more highly than we ought to, and we think we do things that merit our salvation. And that destroys the passive righteousness of Christ. And we don't understand that. No unbeliever ever will, but most Christians don't either. That when you give God a plate of your works, it's destroying what he has done, or at least taking away the honor and glory that he should have, and it's transferred to you. That's why only theologians of glory do that. But listen to 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 6. This is Old Testament, but talk about a long gospel verse. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and he brings up. Wow. Where are you in this contribution to salvation? You're nowhere to be found. In fact, you're not even mentioned. You're certainly not mentioned as the subject of the sentence. You're not mentioned as the object of the sentence because the one doing your salvation is the Lord. It's he who not only runs the verbs, he's running the whole sentence. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up. That's what the Christian religion says. Now, how does the Lord kill you? By showing you the inability of you to meet the conditions that God lays down for salvation. We are killed by the law. That's the purpose of the law, to put our ego to death. What's the purpose of the gospel? To make us alive and bring us up. The bottom line for this hour, then, is how are we righteous? If you're living under the law, as a theologian of self-glory, you become righteous in your eyes by seeking assurance from others, including God. Yeah, God really likes me now, because I finally have found my purpose in life, and insofar as I really start working on that, I have now become useful to God, and that's why God really appreciates me. Well, what's the answer for those who live under the gospel? The theologian of the cross is liberated from the need to find assurance in others or in God. That's amazing. While the theologian of self-glory has to find that assurance, or he loses his identity, we find our identity by no longer having to be looking for assurance from others or from God, because we know what Jesus Christ has done for us. I don't need to be assured by God, because I believe his promises that he died for me. To get back to law and gospel, there's just two ways. The broad way, which is the way of glory through obedience to the law, or the way of the cross. I'm Tom Baker. You've been listening to the first hour of Law and Gospel on AM 850 KFUO on this Thursday, March the 1st. In the second hour, we're going to go and take a look at some of the emails that we're receiving. And you can also phone us during the break. After the news, we'll be back on here, God willing, numbers being 505-7850, toll free at 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, lawgospel@kfuo.org. And by the way, if you would like to have a question for tomorrow, you can use that in-studio email right now, lawgospel@kfuo.org. Hopefully, be talking to you after the break. God bless.
Listen to Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, Monday through Friday at 1:05 p.m. on AM 850 KFUO. You can write Pastor Tom at AM 850 KFUO, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. Or at this email address, lawgospel@lawgospel.com.